Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Tilted World / Economy of Words. And it's about specifically a new book on Logost Press that uses, I think, a beautiful economy of words entitled Tilted World. And our guest for this episode is somebody who knows something about the book Tilted World. Of course, the individual who wrote the book Tilted World. We don't believe in death of the author here just yet. Bart Salarczyk, hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me here.
Oh, it is a pleasure, and thank you for stopping by. And so this new book I want to talk about, Tilted World, which is Logos number 10. So you get one of the round numbers.
Yep.
That's kind of impressive. And as always in this podcast, it's me mostly just geeking out over things that I like or things that I find that people are doing are interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think what makes this collection of poems remarkable, and I say this from a place of envy in the place of someone who can be very wordy in poetry, is the incredible economy of words in your poetics. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about maybe process.
Sure.
And editing and sort of how you achieve this profound effect. Sometimes I was counting some of these. I mean, you know, less than 20 words makes sometimes a hell of a poem, you know.
And well, thanks.
So, yeah.
Well, I guess it is something I've cultivated. I've sort of cultivated, but I think it's also come kind of naturally over the years. Initially, when I go back to looking at, you know, a lot of my earlier work, it was more wordy. You know, there's no doubt about it. At some point, you know, I just started looking at the economy of words. I tend to still write, for the most part, I write longhand in a notebook.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'll write, and then it's almost like sculpting in a way, where I'll look at some things and I'll say, you don't need this, you don't need this, or move some lines here and there, and sometimes just realize, you know, like, the real poem's right here in the middle, or the real poem's the first line and the last line.
Oh, wow.
So it's not, while I'm writing, you know, I try to just keep the writing and the editing separate, you know, I'll write until I feel like, okay, I've got something written here, and then I go back and I edit. Because, I mean, you know, you can always edit.
Yeah.
But you can lose a thought.
Yeah.
Very quickly. And, you know.
Yeah, which, you know, it reminds me of a couple things. One, many, many years ago, when he was Poet Laureate, I had the honor, I guess, to have dinner with Donald Hall. It was at a conference, and I was, like, invited to the cool kids' table. You know, it was open seating. It was like, oh, you know. Yeah. And one of the things that I remarked, or was remarkable for me and sort of changed my poetics, was he had said about how it takes him about a year to write a poem. And from he says that's from first thought to I'm ready to show this to people would be a year-long process. And when I hear you say about that difference between writing and editing, which is something I think a lot of younger writers don't understand, right? That there is almost this, like, separate mind. Is there a separate, you feel like it's a separate mindset for you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if I stop to edit, you know, I mean, I might have a thought, and, you know, in the process of writing, cross out a word, use a different one, but then I keep going, you know. It's only like afterwards will I go back and do the editing part, because, you know, I feel that's just something that works for me, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and is that like, is it, the writing is a moment of, I don't sound too romantic, but, you know, a moment of inspiration?
Yeah, it's, it usually comes with a first line.
Yeah.
It comes with a line, you know, or two, you know, it's just something comes into my head and it's like, oh, write that down.
Yeah.
You know, and then you, you know, I go from there.
Yeah. And so is it like, because for me, it's like, you know, is it like that you have this like, oh yes, I'm thinking deep concentration, and you're sort of in the moment, you know, and there is that, you know, neurological idea of like flow of when people are in deep concentration. Is editing more than this like distant clinical process, or is it a matter of like perspective, like, oh, that has been sitting in a notebook for a week, a day?
a lot of times when once I start writing something, and if I think I have a poem out of it, there's something in here, I'll get it done within a couple of days. I'll do it pretty quickly.
Cool.
You know, and then I'll sort of leave it there. I do in a couple of, you know, there's a couple of groups online through Facebook, Rust Belt Press and Gypsy Art Show, and a few. Pressure Press was an old one that are up there that are, there used to be these old posting boards that some of my friends would run. Now Facebook kind of took that over, so
yes,
people have Facebook groups.
Those, yeah.
And so I'll, you know, periodically I'll post a poem there then, and you get a little bit of feedback on it, you know?
Yeah.
And I do that, although a lot of times, frankly, it's sort of like a circle jerk, everybody stroking everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, if I don't like something, I'll just ignore it. I won't go on and say, oh, this sucks, or offer criticism. You don't get a lot of that. Like people say, oh, I would change this, I would do that. I think back in the 80s and 90s, I saw a little more of that with certain of the posting boards where other poets would come on and say, Mike, maybe you should try this, or, you know. And then sometimes too, you know, like I said, I belong to a number of groups and some of my friends belong to multiple ones, and they'll post the same poem in every group, you know. Mm-hmm. And so then you kind of like, you're seeing it everywhere if you're in that circle.
In that,
you know.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, if I think it's worth something, you know, I'll submit it somewhere, you know, sometimes to online places, a few print places. And I'm not as obsessed with submitting as much as I used to be, but we've been also tied up getting this out. So, you know, this has taken time and energy, you know.
Yeah. Which, and I think about this, so actually one of my favorite, or, you know, I have all these bookmarks in the book of, like, the poems that, like, strike me or find interesting is, I think, the one on page 19, the "And You."
Oh.
Which is about, which is, you know, it is very meta.
Yeah.
Because that is the poem about editing.
Yes.
And I think it so beautifully captures for me that moment. And I think that's the other thing about this collection. So many of these poems are just these, like, things that could be missed in a daily life, you know, or that aren't noticed, you know. It's that kind of,
well, I'm glad it comes across like that to you.
Yeah,
because that's kind of what I
good
yeah I like, you know. I intend that would, you know, it just I get that kind of feedback frequently,
yeah,
you know. And so, you know, it makes me feel I've done something right.
Yeah. And so for me, it is that that poem is so perfectly that feeling that when you are in the moment, like, writing is this, you know.
Yeah. And then you repeat it to yourself again and again, or say it out loud, and then it's like, I love this, you know.
Yes.
And then maybe 2 days later, I don't, you know. But
yes. And I love the, you know, I think also the fourth stanza, you know, growing up maybe Catholic, sinful, self-absorbed.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Catholicism somewhat permeates, I think, a number of the poems.
I've noticed. Yeah,
yeah. 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 Also heard that, you know, if you've grown up Catholic. I grew up Pittsburgh South Side, you know, Catholic school forever. I think the only non-Catholic school I ever attended was probably 2 years at CCAC, because I went to La Roche after that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Duquesne.
Duquesne in the membrane. But yeah, so I love that too, is that, you know, there's this possibility for poetics in daily life.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I look at, you know, that you, there's stuff right in front of you.
Yeah. And that some of them are funny, and some of them are, you know, there's even, you know, some lovely poems about love and sex and, you know, all of that. That, and to be able to capture and distill that down to is, to me, fascinating and really interesting. And I love that poem is like, I don't, you know, actually, could you read it? So people can, actually, you can have my copy so that folks know what we're talking about.
All right. Yeah, this, Don Wentworth published this in Lilliput Review.
Mm.
And when he accepted it, and that was back in the day when you sent things in by mail, you know,
wow.
He was like, yeah, I love this.
Yeah.
All right. The poem is called "And You." When I think the poem complete, I say it again and again. Sinful, self-absorbed. Loving my voice so madly.
Oh! Oh, it's so good. But that is that feeling. I was doing some revising Friday night, my Valentine's Day night was doing revising. And yeah, that feeling of, I'm going to read this again now. I'm going to read this again now. I'm going to read this again now. You know, it's like every poem is, or every piece of writing is a baby. So, you know, and you made it and you birthed it and it's perfect. But let me look at it again and let me mess with this comma or not comma or.
Right.
And it just so captures that feeling so perfectly. Yeah.
And that's something, too, that came with the paring down of words over the years was also really sort of the elimination of most punctuation. I saw a lot of it as unnecessary. Initially, when I was first writing, again, longer poems, I was using like colon, semicolon. I was like, and I'm thinking later, I was like, why? Why am I using this? You know?
Yeah, I mean, this has an exclamation point and an ampersand.
Yes.
Yeah.
I always use the ampersand. I never use and. Yeah. So that's just one little quirk I developed.
Well, you know, it's such a... It's amazing in online culture and like Twitter culture, the ampersand hasn't taken off. Like, shouldn't we be living in the moment of the ampersand? Rather than and.
It's right. Just,
yeah. But yeah, so there's that element of your poetic. So you know, we say back in the day, so how, if I can ask, how old is this poem? Like,
that's probably hard to decide for me to think. I'm probably in the 90s.
Wow, wow.
Maybe early 2000s. I'm not sure. Some of that runs together. There's other ones I'm more certain of, you know. Yeah. But that one I can't quite remember. It's interesting that you would pick that out.
Yeah.
Because to me, you know, I'd pick a lot of other poems in there before that poem is something that struck me, you know.
Yeah.
But that's, again... What's so cool about it is that, you know, different things strike different people. So it's that interaction of the writer and the audience, you know?
Yeah, and I think perhaps this is another element of this economy of words thing that you've brought me to realizing is, does this allow people to color in their own experience?
Yeah, I do. I think that it leaves it open. You know, I mean, sort of it's almost like a haiku philosophy. You know?
Yeah.
Although it's not, I do write haiku also, but, you know, that's more of a... You know, to me, that's kind of the thinking behind it, is like to leave space for people to fill things in. Don't tell the whole story, you know?
Yeah, but sort of capture, I don't want to say capture the essence. I'm too much of an existentialist for that. But yeah, is it capture the essence of that experience?
Right.
Yeah, which that was part of the Donald Hall thing is then, and here's the other thing that was I thought was extreme about him. Now, granted, he's kind of an extreme guy. I mean, he was talking about, at that conference in his keynote address, the death of Jane Kenyon.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he was talking about it, I was like, oh man, this must have happened in the last year. And then I, you know, went to the internet and it was like, that was 8 years ago.
Oh,
and he was still very much in the moment of grief.
Yes.
And I was like, wow. But he then also, for his poems and his reader, and he mentioned this, his reader's copies of the books when he goes out to read still have edits in them.
Oh.
So it's like he said, I don't stop after it's published.
Right.
Which is, wow. Like, that to me was like, that's extreme, you know. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm still tweaking punctuation at this stage, even if I wrote it 30, 40 years prior, which is
right
remarkable.
But that happened with this book also, because some of them, you know, do go back into the 80s. And I did use more punch. So there were some of them where I did... eliminate some, and I even considered another ones, and then I thought, no, just leave it like it is. You know? But,
Yeah, so for me then, if we can think about evolution, though, the longest, can we talk about the long, I guess this is the longest poem in the book, Standing Eight Count.
It's the oldest poem.
That is the oldest poem in the
book. Yes.
Which is, and that is, you know, a very Pittsburgh poem.
Yes.
About our sort of deindustrial past, which...
I wrote that for my dad, although he never... Well, actually, it was for my dad and my uncles. We lived on the south side. We were up on the slope, so the mills were right below us. I could see them.
Oh.
But my dad worked at a factory on the north side in Manchester called Alice Chalmers. Mm. And then they closed down. He lost his job while I was... between my sophomore, junior year of college is when he lost his job for good, but... and then also a number of my uncles worked at J&L right down on Southside.
Oh, wow.
Over at the Hazelwood Works.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I was, you know, witnessing this, you know. And I think I wrote that around 1983 or something.
Oh,
or 82, 83, because that was originally published. There was a great little worker writer paper called the Millhunk Herald. that came out of Pittsburgh.
I knew about this, yes.
And a guy named Larry Evans was behind that, and then Frank Correnti, who later went on to do some things with the earlier Pittsburgh Quarterly, and he was a local poet. And they published that poem, and then later they did an anthology called Overtime, Punching Out with the Millhunk Herald, and it was selected for the anthology.
Oh, wow.
And then it's actually been in a number of other places. I've actually had people say, can I just use this poem? Like Slipstream Magazine out of Niagara had a working stiff issue and said, can I use this?
Yeah, which is strange because, you know, I teach mostly 18-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
And we're actually working on right now this interesting collection by a man named Kevin Koval out of Chicago called Elvis Lives.
Okay.
And it's about white kid into he was the first white Jewish kid in his segregated white Chicago suburb to get into hip hop.
Okay.
And rap music. And then explores like this idea of crossing over and this idea of maybe the Elvis figure, then there's also the white musician who makes black music safe for the masses. And it's a beautiful moral mess of a collection of poems. And there's a poem that we had to talk about yesterday called The Crossover, and it talked about deindustrialization. And my students, and I teach here in Pittsburgh, and most of my students are from Metro Pittsburgh, and they had no idea. They had no idea that that massive change had happened. Because it just happened so long before the idea of them even existed on this planet.
Yeah, it was real. So, you know, I mean, I witnessed it firsthand.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw what it did. You know, I mean, it was a smoky city. There was soot on all the cars. The guys parked by the mill, and there would be this, like, reddish soot that came out on it. They were always washing their cars, and the old ladies in their babushkas were always scrubbing their porches, you know, down on Southside. And so it was dirtier. But there were a lot of jobs, and, you know, and I mean, it was, you know, you could not finish high school and make a living, you know.
Yeah.
And so there was that, you know.
Yeah.
And then there were some much better jobs there. My one uncle was a ladle liner, you know, and so he made some good money. But, you know, at the same time, I think about it killed him. I mean, he died early. He had cancer, you know, and he wore asbestos. And so it was difficult. So, it was like it was an interesting to watch that transition.
Yeah. My grandfather was a steelworker in Johnstown.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a city that's never recovered anything that's beyond the standing eight count. You know, that city has been knocked out and has not gotten conscious again, I think.
Yeah, I feel that way about McKeesport. I have to drive through there sometimes for my job, and it's like, you know, damn, man, it's like 40 years later, McKeesport still hasn't even seemed to approach a comeback, you know, where I've seen, you know, Southside had the whole kind of renaissance in a way, and then I don't know, now I think it's going the other direction, but got to see that, and then so it was unique, you know. And there was benefits. I mean, the city did get cleaner. Now I think, you know, the air's pretty bad again, but
the air's pretty bad again,
but it was real bad, you know, back in the day. And
I
recently had a poem in the Post Gazette that addressed that. It was looking back.
That's right. That is right.
Third hand clunker.
But, my wife works in the downtown McKeesport.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
so,
the buildings that needed to be boarded
up. Oh, yeah.
Aren't even boarded up.
No.
You know, I mean, the radical neglect.
Yes.
That happened.
It's rough, you know, because I even see, you know, Braddock making some signs of, you know, finally coming back. You know, when I was a kid, my dentist was at Braddock. My mother would take me there and would shop in Braddock, and it was, you know, it was booming. You know, it was a booming place. But yes, that was the oldest poem in the book. So it's and Scott really felt it should start with that poem. And also on the back, you know, there's a quote from that poem. And I know Chris felt pretty strongly. There was a couple of options, and he said, I really like this option the best, quote from it. So. So I was pleased with that.
I guess maybe actually this one, if I could request, and then we could talk about poems you want to talk about.
Oh, sure, whatever.
But actually, could I request a reading of Standing Eight Count again, so that the good folks who are...
I read this frequently in readings, and sometimes I worry people get sick of it, you know?
Well, now you will have a document. It'll be on the internet, which is forever until the magnetic poles reverse, and then hopefully somebody, you know, burned this on a CD or something.
All right, Standing Eight Count. Here he comes, climbing the countless city steps, dragging his feet along the crumbling concrete, head bowed yet proud, like a wounded warrior who refuses to be carried home on his shield. I watch him from the kitchen window, shopping bag stuffed with soiled work clothes, hair slicked back with grease and sweat, battered lunch pail underneath one arm, and from here I can almost smell the 3 after-work beers on his breath. After 26 years, this homeward path has grown familiar to his aching feet, but today he bears a new burden. As he enters through the back door, my eyes meet his. Sad and heavy, I know their message without words. Another furnace down, another layoff, another knockout punch fielded by an aging champion. And then the analogy for the boxing, I mean, it was more just, you know, these guys were kind of out on their feet. You know,
yeah.
That's what I saw, you know, when I looked at them. They were still going to work. They knew it was over. They knew it was over. But they were still going until the end.
Yeah. And, yeah, I used to work with a guy who, he worked at Westinghouse, and he was in their communications department.
Mm-hmm.
And what then became his job was the termination letter, the official termination letters.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And so he went through that, and the last one he wrote was his own.
Yeah.
That was his last day on the job. Mm-hmm. But 4:58, he typed his name into the word processing system and hit print. Because he just, yeah, which is to me kind of chilling, you know? Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. So what poems in here do you want to talk about, or which ones do you think are, you know, we talked about the oldest poem, we talked about some of the oldest poems. Which ones are representative of maybe your poetics now and where you are? And
well, let's see.
Yeah.
Probably any number of them. I am. Well, you get some lighting on it here.
Yes.
Sure.
Sorry, this office has an opium den vibe to it. But
I actually, I really like the title poem. I wrote this a few years back, but this was one of my walking the dog poems. I don't, not as much lately, but back in the day, more when I'd walk whatever dog I had at the time, as I'd be walking the dog. Like on a weekend in the morning, suddenly some lines would start coming to me. And I didn't have a notebook with me, you know, I didn't travel, like I'm walking. And so what I would do is I would have that line. Then if I came up with a second line, I would repeat it. Then I would repeat them both. And I would work it so I had something memorized, somewhat memorized. And then as soon as I would get in the door, I'd run like to the kitchen table and find a piece of paper and scrawl it down as much as I could. And then I would shape it. So I wrote this actually walking dog. I currently have Roxy up at Charman Park, which is right on the street where I live. And I live in the suburbs in the North Hills in Ross Township.
Okay.
And that's where. So this is called Tilted World. For every pair of mismatched socks, there's a blind man happy to oblige. For every sock lost in the dryer, there's a weary amputee. I walk in peace. I mean no harm. Still, the crow shits on my head. Such exquisite balance requires a tilted world. Mm.
Love that. Yeah.
Wow. You did?
Yeah. No, that's great. Wow. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's, it's strange to think about, you know, it's that the, you know, ending poem, that there is a metaphysical vision in that, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every pair of mismatches is a blind man happy to oblige. Yeah. Walk in peace and mean no harm. Still the crow shits on, I love, oh, it's such a good line. Which is, I think that is, and I think there is a lovely balance, actually, and I think that's such a great, now thinking about the whole collection, mm-hmm. it as a title poem, because there are a lot of poems that, you know, react to, you know, I don't want to say mundane, but typical daily experience.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also this, you know, I don't know if you call it the element of the fantastic or just the element of, you know, shit happens mm-hmm. in life.
Yes.
That I think the mood of these poems captures really well. And that we do live in a, you know. And again, this the me that works with, you know, idealistic, pampered, you know, somewhat comfortable suburban 18-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the thought that the world might, you know, or you might have a world where there's not, you might be offered no good choices, or you might be offered random disaster.
Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, which is something people would like to think about, but makes a lovely poem. You know. Yeah. Which reminds, well, signing off. Or, I mean, I think for me, like a poem like on 66, My Strange Daughter.
Oh, is... see, that was one I debated putting in. I was telling Scott I didn't think I wanted it there. Mm. And then he was like, no, keep it. Mm. So, yeah. Try to read that one? Or
yeah.
All right. My Strange Daughter. We share a cloud. Then I say, just to be a jag off. So much that we love isn't real. She says I'm raining on her Lunchable. 21 years old, stoned with the old man, eating a Lunchable.
I love that. And the word Lunchable is such a great poetic word.
Well, she was 21 and still eating Lunchables. So, you know, those little packets, you know. They,
oh, yeah.
That's
oh,
what, that's, yeah. I was like, how do you eat that shit? But, you know.
Yeah, that's the Lunchable is such a ridiculous item in the world, you know, mm-hmm. because yeah, it is childish, it's immature, and it's perfect. We had thought at one point of for one of my birthday parties of, just catering it with Lunchables.
Oh my God!
Just going to the grocery store or going. I guess we would have had to order it online. Just, you know, buy 50 Lunchables.
Oh my Lord. That would have been something.
Give everybody their Lunchable, but yeah, again, that for one is that is such a singular experience,
mm-hmm.
but it's so relatable, you know. I guess that's the other thing is like, how do you strike that balance from something that's maybe uber personal,
mm-hmm.
but yet knowing, you know, or trusting an audience that, oh, they're going to get this. Or they're going to be able to relate to the absurdness of the mm-hmm. situation, but, you know.
Well, done right, you know, I mean, the personal becomes universal, and that's where yeah. I think that, you know, I'm not the first one to say this.
Or, yeah, you're not the first one to say this.
Yeah, well, but I believe in that, you know, that that's where, and that also is something that came more with my writing, of, you know, because when you initially start writing, you feel this need, you're going to sit down and write something very impressive, and you end up sounding like somebody else or a bunch of other people, you know, mixed together. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't work, yeah. you know? And so you work, you do have to work to find your own voice.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think that's something for me as, you know, writing teacher, I find students, my students really struggle with. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, there's that desire to write the epic.
Yeah.
You know, which mm-hmm. is, I think, a very interesting, you know, progression if we think about, because there is an epic quality to standing eight count.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a way in which that, you know, I think are people are drawn to that poem because it summarizes an era and the end of an era in the city's history. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, and the end of an era in a lot of cities' history.
Yes.
You know, but this other one, you know, appeals in a very different way in that, well, I don't know, I guess do we have, I mean, I guess we're all aware we have these absurd little moments and like, mm-hmm. yeah, Lunchables.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, and that, you know, how to get, and that's something I struggle with in terms of talking with my students or trying to guide them, because they want to write epics.
Yeah.
They want to write mm-hmm. the thing that will be applicable to all and the Hauser of the universal truth or whatever. And they can't.
Right. Yeah, that's what you go looking for. Then sometimes you find you write some simple little poem that, you know, you scribbled out that
yeah.
has a certain level of profundity to it. You know, you feel like this, yeah, okay, this says a lot, you know.
And I love the word, jagoff's in there.
Oh, of course.
Yes. You know, and I think also there is, you know, the cynicism of age, and I don't know if that, do you feel like that is a part of your poetics? That,
oh, yeah.
You know, you've seen a lot of shit not work out.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, I really believe that wisdom, you know, comes with age if you allow it, if you're open to it. And, you know, I had, you know, way back when I was at CCAC, between 73 and 75, I did have a psychology professor that talked about experience and said that, you know, he'll encounter people that will say, well, I've had 30 years experience. And his response is, no, you have 1 year 30 times, you know. And,
yeah.
And I believe that, you know, you have to be open to learning new things and continue that process. And, you know, I do like to believe that now I'm smarter than I used to be. And
yeah.
That I feel that, you know, and I also feel, yeah, there is a certain weariness. I'm not ready to give the ghost yet, but there is a certain weariness and a certain of things like, I don't need to deal with this bullshit. You know, I can just let a lot more go and focus on what I want to be, you know, and who I want to be. I'm not trying to impress anybody anymore, you know, in any way.
And so, yeah, for that poem to go from so much we love isn't real to eating a Lunchable.
Yeah, that's just... I have no idea. Sometimes I have no idea where my poems are going, and I don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll look at it and somebody will say, well, what does that mean? And I'll say, I don't know. To me, it's almost sometimes like word collages. But I like the way it looks on a page, and I like the way it sounds. And so I'm just going to leave it there.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's something intuitive of that. But, you know, me, the lyricist thing, you know, I think for me, it's like to go from this, you know, so much we love isn't real to, I mean, there is a surreality to the Lunchable. I mean, just even the way it's packaged. I mean, it does seem like it should be what the lunches in 2001 look like.
I always call it astronaut food.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, that's what I'll call it. It's like it's astronaut food. You know, and that's what I'll just say. Like, it's not something that's meant for human consumption, really, you know, unless you're in outer space. It's like,
yeah, which I think this, you know, industrial world that we live in has so much of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it's like we just perfectly accept Lunchables in your metaphysics, but so much we love isn't real. Lunchables are not real.
We're barely real. Yes.
Barely real. But edible, but enjoyable.
Yeah.
What else? What other poems do you, for you, like, best represent? What's the greatest hits? What's the K-Tell? Or is this the K-Tell book?
It may be. I mean, I don't know. Not necessarily, because I have other, you know, poems that I really like that are included. What I did here is that I've had, over the years, I've had 9 chapbooks published. The first was in 1989.
Oh,
those 3 I gave you there are the only ones that are really still available, okay, in print. And so I didn't use anything from any of those books. I didn't, and there are some poems in there that are some of my favorite poems, okay, by myself. But I felt that I didn't want to repeat things, have them in this book when they're still available there. You know? Now, somewhere down the line, if I'm fortunate enough to do another bigger book, you know, I may pull some out of those, you know, along the way. But in here, there are some, you know, like Standing Acorn was in my very first chapbook. And that was 1989, you know, you know, I pulled it out of there, you know, just to keep it, you know, I felt that, you know, I wanted it in here, definitely.
Yeah. And so real quick, as you're looking, so the 3 books, the 3 other chapbooks are available. Of course, there's Tilted World through Logos Press that I will have the link on the podcast. There's Walt Whitman's Watching.
Mm-hmm.
Vicodin and the Christian Broadcasting Network, which is my favorite title.
Yeah, that's a good one.
and Right Direction. Mm-hmm. And I will post... so actually, it's bsolarczyk, bsolarczyk at comcast.net.
That's
if you want to get hooked up, especially with the chapbooks. I know Tilted World will be available and Caliban Books and other places.
Mm-hmm.
But those, and also actually also at readings. And you do have a reading coming up, which is the book launch party.
Yep.
For, and I will post that link on the on the FaceTube. But that is Saturday night, correct?
Saturday the 22nd, starting at 7 p.m. at the Coffee Buddha.
At the Coffee Buddha.
In the North Hills. It's on Perrysville Avenue. And they have a Facebook page.
You can look,
and then,
and I'll have that link.
And they're actually, you know, the Coffee Boot has been good to me poetically over the years. And unfortunately, they're closing down at the end of the month.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to be the last kind of poetry reading there. We've done other ones there. And outside, we've read outside at the fire pit in the nicer weather. So, you know, the owners of the Coffee Buddha, Mike and Cassie, they've been wonderful people. And they've done a lot for arts and just having a spot like that in the North Hills, you know. Yeah. We wouldn't necessarily expect to find it there. They've hosted bands and wonderful parties, Halloween parties and such. Yes. So it's going to be missed.
Yes, it's going to be missed. And it is the year of our Lord 2020, I should say, because the internet is forever. So it's, so it might go February 22nd, you know, 2023, and, you know, not know where the Coffee Buddha is anymore. But the Coffee Buddha will be no more by then.
So we're going to hopefully give it a nice send off. And Bobby Paycheck will be reading.
Oh, fantastic.
And Jenny Ashburn and Jason.
Oh, great. Oh,
those are the three people I asked to be part of.
Oh, that's
there's so many people to select from, but I've read with Jason Baldinger before, with Scott a few times, and Chris, so it was nice to...
Yeah.
I wanted to have these folks on board.
That's a great lineup. That is a great, great lineup.
Mm-hmm. Here's a poem here. This is kind of a really personal poem, so I don't know how it would go over, but I wrote this for... a good friend, probably the best friend I ever made through poetry, was a guy who lives in Erie named Ron Androla. And when I came on to the small press scene, people knew who Ron was. I mean, you know, and Ron and I did a number of poetry adventures together. I mean, we traveled to Buffalo and Detroit and to Kent and Cleveland and a number of places to do readings together, readings at the Erie Art Museum. And we were wilder and younger, and, you know, so we had a hell of a good time. But... Ron grew up in Elport, Pennsylvania, and then he started college at Point Park, and then he ended up going to an experimental school modeled after Black Mountain up in New Hampshire. I think it was called Franconia College up in Franconia Notch in the White Mountains. And that's where he met his now wife, Anne. But he had been married prior, went through divorce, and Anne had been married prior. And then they reconnected years later after being divorced. Oh. But while Ron was at Franconia, he got some sort of grant, and he went... somewhere, I don't know if it was Sicily, Sardinia, or whatever, but he was going to be a writer. And he wrote, I guess, you know, wrote constantly, and wherever he was renting, and he was starving. And he said the landlord took pity on him and gave him, like, stale bread and oranges. And that was kind of what he lived on.
Oh, wow.
For the longest time. But this was sort of an important period in his writing life. And then, you know, Ron was admired by many, many people, you know, and he's still up there in Erie, but he's sort of keeping a low profile these days. But anyway, I've written a number of poems with Ron and for Ron over the years. And I kind of like this one. It's called Dreams Fall Home for Ron Androla. Elport boy on an island eating oranges and stale bread. A frozen lake, a love rekindled, 10,000 poems away. But someday, fat with sugar, a thin ghost browns a corner. A man meets himself where dreams fall home.
So good.
And it was nice to see Ron happy, you know, again, and with his wife, Anne.
Yeah.
You know.
A man meets himself where dreams fall home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's that is a perspective that I think only time can give.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
You know. And I was writing, I mean, I was thinking of years of friendship and some of the things we did. And,
yeah.
You know, how suddenly you become older and you're like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
What happened to us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, but I think that's, you know, where you think about too for me in that poem is that, you know, also the weird ways in which you can see if you have long-term friendships, people finding themselves.
Yeah.
People either over time, and this has been, you know, now that I'm in my 40s, the thing I've noticed, people either find themselves or lose themselves completely. And there's no middle ground.
Yeah, you have to fight to keep going. I mean, you have to fight to continue, you know, to maintain a perspective and, you know, to kind of not succumb and just become... I don't want to be that bitter old man shaking his fist at kids, you know, get off my lawn and shit, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I joke about becoming that, but I really don't want to become that, you know.
Well, I think it's also people's creative spark, people's individuality, and the ways in which life gets in the way. Where dreams fall home, though.
Well, I'm glad you like it so much.
I'm Me too. And I'm glad. Thank you for doing this.
Sure, I'm enjoying it.
Yes. Of course, the one opposite of that, the great one, the waking up with Jesus.
Oh, man, that was just like almost a throwaway one, you know. That's one of those ones where I just... Sometimes if I'm writing, you know, I might write a couple poems in a row or something, and then there's this little thing I just write down and thinking, oh, yeah, that's just a little throwaway something. And then later realize that was the best poem you wrote out of that batch, you know. But it just takes some time to realize that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's also is like, I mean, you talked earlier about like the sort of the forums and like sort of feedback. I mean, that's always, isn't that always a weird, I mean, did you find as you matured as a poet, like you have a better sense of what an audience wants or what?
I never write for an audience. I just write for what I like. I write, the kind of world we're in is that I really don't give a shit. You know, it's like, if you don't like it, fine. Move on, you know. You can say what you want about it. I don't care. I'm not going to fight with you about it. I'm not going to argue with you about what this, and I don't care. You know, I find that, a lot of that's a waste of time. You know, it's if you and somebody else want to debate what my poems mean, by all means. Or if you want to say, this is what it means to me, but if you're like, well, I don't get it, I don't really like your stuff, that's fine. There's a lot of other poets you could read. You know?
So Roland Barthes is right. The author is dead. Mm-hmm. Even though you're in the chair. You're embracing the death of the author, which is probably the best place to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, you know, there's that story of Philip Roth. He was vanity surfing and he got to the Wikipedia page on the human stain.
Oh.
And there was a link, and it said, oh, he read about this in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. This central conflict that kicks off the story. And he goes in, and he tried to edit it. And he said, no, it happened to a psychology friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And Wikipedia was like, well, that's an unsubstantiated edit you've made. And he went back and changed it and said, no, I wrote the damn book, you know. And they kept, and ultimately he got banned for, well, which was 2 years, the rest of his life from ever editing Wikipedia.
Really? I never
and
heard
the
of
formal,
this.
The formal letter they wrote to him, because the whole thing was absurd, is there was a dead link saying that he had given this interview, that he said, yeah, I read about this in the paper and that's what started the novel. And the link was dead, but there was a link. And he even, like, looked up his publicist's date book from that era, from 1990, when that book came out, and said, look, I never gave an interview to this magazine. I don't know where this link came from. You can't find the link. And they were literally saying, well, if you can, like, provide a link that you didn't give this interview or whatever. Well, so they banned him for life, which at that point was only 2 or 3 years. But the letter, I guess, they sent him, the formal registered letter, they said, you're banned for life. And it was, just because you wrote the book doesn't mean you're an expert on it.
Right. How do you like that? Like,
I don't think he did. I mean, knowing what I know of Philip Roth, I do not think he would have enjoyed being, you know, told he was not an expert in his own book.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, I think we have time for one or two more
before
we move on to the bottom five and we do the hard sell again. Yes.
All right. Well, earlier I did the Standing Acon, so this was something more recent for my father. And this is when he was dying in a nursing home. He was in Manor Care, very close to my house. And I took family leave for a while from work, and I was visiting him every day. And so I called it Dad These Days. Curled like a question mark, a life outlives itself. We watch Jeopardy. I feed them what they bring. Blue-eyed bone confusion rattling the halls. I walk away. He calls for God. The elevator smells like piss. My dad was frequently calling. I could hear him down the hall as I would get off the elevator. God, God help me, God help me. And then I'd walk into the room and he'd completely change. Whoa, what are you doing here? And I was like, I came to visit you. And he was still convinced till the end that he was home. He would ask me to go down and make him a sandwich, and I'd try to explain to him that, you know, you're not really there. What are you talking about? I just went out, I was out in the yard today. You probably were in your head, you know. But
wow.
But that was a tough, that's another, you know, thing you... you go through, and you know.
Yeah, I went through that. I have a very good friend who's going through. Her mother has some form of dementia, and has declined so rapidly in, you know, it's been like 18 months that she had to move home, and yeah, despair and bodily fluids, you know.
Yeah. It was rough.
Yeah.
Can I do like a couple more?
Yeah, sure.
Just
yeah, we don't really have a time limit. I just, you know, I have a lot of poems
I've written for my wife, but you know, this she's just sort of implied in here. But yeah. Gave me a thought one day again, you know, about mortality and a joyful moment, but also mortality. And it's called "I Smile Back." Mm. You're smiling in the doorway. I smile back, but can't help thinking. Someday, one less smile, and someday. Just an empty doorway. And this poem here, I've always liked this poem. I don't, but this might be, I don't know. You can tell me what you think of it, but it's called Gravity Anchors Our Dreams. It's on page 54.
Thank you.
Gravity Anchors Our Dreams. If it all had been different, it would still end the same. Kindness leveled off. Love ladled in small portions. The meaning of a man, the give and the big take. His salt collar, his good dogs run away.
I put a bookmark in that one. That is one of the ones I did definitely want to talk about because, again, I love that, you know, the title does so much work.
Yeah.
In that poem, and it allows you, and it gives you this, it gives you, bad pun maybe intended, you know, this anchor.
Yeah.
Point. Yeah, if it had all been different, it would still end the same. One of the other books I'm teaching this semester is the graphic novel, It's a Good Life If You Don't Weaken, by the Canadian comic book artist Seth. And he is part of this... You know, part of the plot or the main plot of this graphic novel, My Students Love Me, is literally this guy trying to hunt down this obscure comic book artist from the mid-20th century. What happened to this guy? And he eventually finds the man's best friend and talks about, you know, his friend was a comic artist, got a gag cartoon in The New Yorker, and eventually moved back home to this little town in Canada and sold real estate. And this question, how could you give up? How could he have given up cartooning if it was his calling? And eventually the friend who's, you know, in advanced in age says, well, we realize, you know, you realize sometimes how little control you have of life and you just kind of get pulled along and your decisions don't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, which, you know, there's, I've always sort of appreciated Taoism, you know, it's sort of like almost that path of least resistance type of thing and just kind of letting things come down. I mean, you know, over the years at work, we think, let's come up with a 5-year plan. Let's do a 7-year plan. And I was like, the fuck you're talking about? Nobody knows what's going to happen 5 years from now. And, and I always used to tell people that we're going to do our plans again. No, look, last time we tried this shit, let's all go back and find those plans and see if any of that came to be. You know, it hasn't, you know. So you can only, what I would rather focus on is preparing for what happens. I want to make myself feel like I'm grounded. Okay, shit's going to happen. I don't know what it is. So how do I work on myself so I'm best prepared to happen, whatever it is, you know, respond to whatever that shit is. Yeah. That's how I, you know, look at it, you know. And so I'd rather focus on that, you know. How do we get through anything that comes down, you know? And some of those are just basic principles of, you know, love each other, have good friends, you know.
Yeah.
Strike a balance. I mean, work, but have fun, you know. Don't lose that. Have a sense of humor because you're really going to need it.
Yeah. And I just love the line, love ladled in small portions.
Yeah.
I hear that. I mean, that line speaks to me in thinking about a lifetime. You know.
But sometimes it's enough as long as you've had some love, you know. Sometimes you look through, you know. I had a poem years ago I wrote for somebody, and it was, I had a line in there, you know, that I tried to find a diamond in a dunghill, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's kind of what I... You digging through your, you were out there's a bunch of shit. You dig through it, but every once in a while you find a diamond, you know, and that's what makes things worthwhile.
Yeah.
How about if I just read one more
poem? One more poem. How about this? As you cue that up, I will say again. So the book is Tilted World by Bart Sularchek, available on Logos Press. I'll have a link to, I think, the Logos site or whatever when I post this online. If you want any of other Bart's books, well, just go to one of his readings and buy one there. But if you can't wait, or maybe you're not from Pittsburgh, B. Sularchek, B-S-O-L-A-R-C-Z-Y-K, at C-O-M-C-A-S-T, comcast.net. And again, all of these links will be on the website. And again, the books are Tilted World, Right Direction, Vicodin and the Christian Broadcasting Network, and Walt Whitman's Watching. Mm-hmm. And before we go to the bottom five, what's the last poem?
Well, the last poem, it's a short one, and this always makes me think of my friend Megan Tudelo. I met Megan at the Coffee Buddha at a poetry reading, first time I ever met her, and I kind of went on this riff about how I've enjoyed mushrooms over the years and some things I've written while on mushrooms on the way down, and but I could recall two or three of them that I had written down, but because it was a mushroom poetry, I had no idea there could have been thousands of mushroom poems. Well, I know. But anyway, you know, this was one I wrote. Megan really enjoyed it, so I'm sending this out to you, Megan. I hope you'll be listening. This is called The Last Mushroom. Mothmen smack the windows as our satellite dies. Let's untie the kids and go bowling.
Oh, the lovely surrealism.
Yes, that's, you know, that's a, end with that, you know. Yes.
All right, so now it's time for the bottom five.
Okay.
Bottom five is, well, this is more surrealism. That's actually a perfect transition.
Okay.
And now it's time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. You ready for it? All right. Question one is the question everybody gets first time on the podcast.
All right.
If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, you know, single-celled thing, body, what kind of disease, illness, or illness would you like to be?
Would athlete's foot count? I don't know.
Yeah! You know, that's a good one!
I'd be a fungus, you know, just like a fungal infection. So, you know, I mean, kind of an irritant, but nothing fatal.
That's amazing!
I don't think anybody dies of
athlete's... No, nobody dies of athlete's foot.
So I don't want to be mean.
Yeah! 83 podcasts in... No one has said athlete's foot yet, and that might be the best answer.
Well, thank you.
Yes. All right. Question two. Name an item from your childhood that you lost or got rid of that you most wish you could get back.
Of course, we could say our innocence, but that's not an item. You know. I'm sure other people have said that.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I have a vague recollection. This was very early on. I may have been a toddler, like 3 years old or something, but I did have this stuffed kind of an animal something. I recalled somewhat looking like a clown or something that I carried with me. And my one uncle, my dad's one brother, had an old milk truck that he bought, and he painted it, and he called it the Gray Goose. And I remember he took me out. Of course, there were no seatbelts or anything. We sat on milk crates, you know. And I have this memory of me losing it out the door onto the highway and being heartbroken that I never found it. So it's very vague. Very, very vague.
Oh, wow.
But that comes to mind when you ask that question. It was like the first loss that I can really think of. I remember crying that I lost it.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That's heavy. Well, we're keep going. All right. Keep going on the heavy. Question three. It's the Christopher Hitchens question. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write?
Living villains?
Living villains. They have to still be with us. Because in Mortality, Christopher Hitchens, when he gets diagnosed, he's like, you know, I was really looking forward to reading the obituaries of Cardinal Ratzinger and Henry Kissinger.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, wait, I wanted to write those. And, you know, that he didn't get to. So for you, of the living villains of history, what would be the best? And this could be, you know, either this is, you know, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or the way I think about it is almost like, what would the Faustian villain tale be like? Or you can go one of two ways with it.
I don't know, maybe Donald Trump, you know, just just write, you know, that might be, for me, a joyful obituary.
Yes. Thing, right?
And, you know, just kind of, I don't think it would have to be too long.
No, it wouldn't have to be too long.
I think it could just be, and it might just be a celebration. Maybe the most celebratory obituary ever written.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had those Thatcher death parties in Scotland, in the north of England, so... That'll be a weird one when that happens. That's going to be...
That would be very weird, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that for me replaces... I had that thought years before Michael Jackson died. Like, mm-hmm. when that happens, it's going to be weird. And it was. Mm-hmm. But I think Donald Trump's death, which, at you know, the way that guy takes care of himself, it could be tomorrow.
Yep.
It could be happening right now. All right, so you talked about Catholic influence.
Well,
so question four.
Mm-hmm.
What would your idea of purgatory be like?
Well, again, I have a memory and an image. Fourth grade, I was a Catholic school, St. Adalbert's grade school, and my desk was here, and there was a bulletin board here, and I can't remember what month it was, because there was always months set aside for something, and one of the months was Poor Souls in Purgatory Month. And we were constantly encouraged to pray for the poor souls in purgatory. When you're done with your work, put your head on your desk and pray for the poor souls in purgatory. And we were taught that we needed to do this because they would then pray for us when it was our turn when we were in purgatory. Okay? So again, remember, I'm in fourth grade, okay? And to the left of me is this bulletin board that the nun put together, and she cut out gray paper, made this very nice decoration. And what it was is, at the bottom there were flames, and there were hands reaching up out of the flames, okay? And then there was a ladder, and it went up to the cloud, and then that was heaven, okay? And there were people up in heaven reaching down to pour those people up. And if I remember correctly, there was actually sometimes, but if we said enough prayers for the poor souls in purgatory, she had like a cutout of a person that would start to climb the ladder up out of this. So guess that would be my vision of purgatory.
That's an intense
turn
vision
to my left
for fourth grade.
Well, I mean, you know, Catholic school was full of, you know, saints with their eyeballs plucked. You went to get a drink of water. There's a saint holding their eyeballs in their hand right by the water fountain. There's a story behind that. And,
oh, wow.
You know, and then a 2,000-year-old murder. I mean, Christ hanging right there, and they're trying to pin this on you. You know, it's like, I had nothing to do with it, but, you know.
Oh, boy.
That was a heavy answer. When the nun would leave the room, if you talk one out of the room, you're putting another thorn in Jesus' crown. And that's the thing
right.
We would be told
that.
At like age 7.
All right. Question five then. And this is going to maybe continue the thread. I thought about this. Thinking about your poem, so maybe it is related. It's a lie. What's your earliest memory?
Ooh. That's a good one. My earliest memory, I think, might be, I know we were living in a place in Mount Oliver, and it was, I remember we shared a duplex in Mount Oliver up and down. We had the upstairs two floors, and downstairs my cousin, my mother and her sister, my mother and Aunt Eleanor and her husband, Uncle Kenny, and my dad and I, you know, mom lived upstairs. And my cousin Kenny's like 6 months older than me, so we grew up together. You know, we grew up. And I remember us racing our tricycles from the backyard, from the front yard, like through this little alley that went to the backyard and back around. And my Uncle Kenny was very into cars, and he drove in demolition derbies, and he would do stock cars. And he also was a auto body, you know, that's how he made his living. And back in those days, there were... two local stock car drivers named Gus and Dick Linder, I believe, the Linder brothers. And Kenny and I, Uncle Kenny, of course, told us about them and talked them up, and we would play Gus and Dick Linder, riding our tricycles, racing through the, you know, there's tons of memories from there. 203 Rustic Avenue, still remember it. And, tons of memories of that time living together, because it's so, I mean, to grow up, you know, with family downstairs and, you know, have a cousins like that, and just, you know, it was... And they weren't always the best of times. You know, I remember got the gas shut off one time, and Uncle Kenny came home and turned it back on himself. He figured it out. But that's probably my earliest memory. I go right back to there.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it's going to be about something. Maybe the new Christopher Collins book, or I don't know, something. It's because something's going to happen. Yes. Something's going to happen. We can't prepare
something
for
always
it.
Does.
Yes. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and when I remember, we go on Mixcloud too. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to our guest, author of Tilted World, Walt Whitman's Watching, Vicodin, the Christian Broadcasting Network, and Right Direction, and I'll have links where you can find all those wonderful things. Bart Solarchek, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Later, meets. 2, 3, 4.